Good afternoon. The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. Three bills which we will take in order. Start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 264A. Zach.
Senate Bill 264A exempts county roads from requirements to get an approach permit for the change of use for a private approach road.
Thank you. And as we wait for the sign-up sheet, I'm guessing that perhaps someone from ODOT wants to be heard. It hasn't reached me yet, but Director Garrett, please come forward. And bring anyone else you like.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and with me is Bob Bryant. Bob is our Region 4, Central Oregon Region Manager. But Mr. Bryant was detailed to be the ODOT point, specific to the Access Management Committee and the Access Management Conversations. I'm going to quickly speak about the context in which we engage the issue, as well as some of the policy issues, and then turn it over to Mr. Bryant for some of the procedural activities that took place. We come to you today as one of about two dozen folks who made up an access management committee, and we recommend the proposed language that exists in Senate Bill 264A. I'll tell you the context in which we engaged. Over the last several years, as we rode circuit, there was a critique of this agency, as with our various access planning rules, that we were anti-development, anti-growth, we were inconsistent in the way we handled the permitting process, and that we had become a source of frustration for the developers, local government folks. Now, that's not who we are as a department. As a matter of fact, I would submit we are on the opposite side of those conversations, and I certainly appreciated the perception, but the perception is a reality specific to the AM, or access management conversation. So with that, we entered this conversation with the reality that either we could come to the table and actually help shape our future, or we would have it shaped for us. So in really the authoritative conversation took place in the February 2010 legislative session. House Bill 1024 became foundational to the piece of work we have in front of you today. But House Bill 1024 had a twofold charge, the first being the agency to engage with this Access Management Committee in order to develop legislation that clarifies and brings consistency to the issuance of access permits, and these permits need to be based on objective standards. The second charge was established access management rules and standards that are less stringent for those highway segments that carry 5,000 vehicles a day or less. So with that as foundation, we jumped off, brought again a disposition to the table to seek to find balance, a balance between safety, a balance between operational opportunities on the state highway system, and a balance with economic development opportunities and growth opportunities across the state of Oregon. So simply put, what we did was we added a new variable, the economic variable, into the equation. Prior to this conversation, I will tell you the primary focus of my agency was specific to operations and safety. So we've added this economic variable into the mix here. So what from a policy perspective, what this language does is that the access management requirements are now in statute. They used to be in rule. That was something that was a significant conversation that played itself out over the course of the committee's gatherings. The less stringent standards for spacing is now in statute rather than the Oregon Highway Plan, so a policy document transferred to statutory language. And the onus to prove or to demonstrate that safety or operational efficiency was compromised now lies with the agency, whereas before we would place that onus on the applicant or the developer. So that said, we acknowledge that there's some risk here. We have taken some risk here. There's some exposure in terms of more access points on state highways that will more than likely cause some congestion, and that will reduce some mobility. We've made that known. But I think all folks around the table enter this conversation with their eyes wide open, be it the local government folks who engage the land use conversations, be it the developers or the applicants themselves, and ODOT. Understand the risk we're taking, fine. and then let us move forward to do good things. I will tell you, with this language, my agency stands ready to implement. And what I'd like to do right now, Mr. Chairman, is turn over to Mr. Bryant to walk through some of the procedural type requirements engaged and embedded in this document.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Bryant.
Chair and members of the committee, again, Bob Bryant with the Oregon Department of Transportation, region manager out of our Central Oregon region. And as the director has pointed out, Senate Bill 264 really represents a culmination of the collaborative work that ODOT did along with the stakeholder committee that we had help us work through our rules for how we administer access to state highways. And it represents a couple of significant areas of change, one in the area of procedure and how we process applications for direct access onto the state highway, as well as the formation and foundation for a set of objective standards that we would use for evaluating and reviewing applications for direct approach to state highways. The procedural changes together with those objective standards constitutes a fairly significant policy shift from where we've been before and how ODOT balances the goals, our goal and responsibility in managing traffic safety and mobility on the state highway system with the important goal of assisting local government and the development community in economic development opportunities and urban growth business opportunities within our communities. So with that as the foundation, there were a number of areas that we worked with our Access Management Committee on to bring change to how we looked at approach applications for driveways, specific access to the state highway. First of all, with regard to reasonable access, our rules today allow ODOT to take into account existing access to a property that abuts a state highway and make a determination and deem whether that existing access, from ODOT's perspective, is reasonable to serve the property. And, of course, as the director pointed out, our focus in administering the current rule has been on the transportation system more so than the business aspect. And so that created angst over the years that resulted in a lot of interest by our Access Management Committee to make change in how we look at existing access as part of this process. And in fact, that resulted in was eliminating that determination as to whether existing access for properties within an urban growth area had alternative access or not, and instead directed us to look at these objective standards that were formed as the basis for whether or not we could support a permit for an additional direct access to the highway. The standards themselves are sort of a three-prong approach. Our current Oregon Highway Plan calls for access spacing standards for measuring the location of access relative to either a driveway on either side or an intersecting street. So that's one of the standards that carried forward into this work. But in addition to that, we also created a standard for site distance that would apply to applications. And then the third piece is the lane configuration required to safely accommodate an additional driveway or an approach to the state highway. And in looking at the lane configuration, that's primarily whether or not channelization is necessary to accommodate the turning movements that would be necessitated by the driveway. We look at the highway volumes, the volumes that are generated by the site itself, the posted speed, and the classification of the roadway to make a determination as to whether or not there are sufficient lanes existing to safely accommodate the driveway. The idea is that if the applicant meets these objective standards, we wouldn't require any further engineering analysis like we typically would or have in the past. If they meet the standards, they would be permitted a driveway. If they're coming in for a subsequent driveway to the state highway in the urban area and met the standards, they would likewise be permitted a subsequent driveway. So again, we won't be looking at existing access as part of that. In rural areas, very similar. The only change in the rural area is if there are, after the first driveway, if there is a request for additional driveways in a rural area, we do have the ability under the existing language to talk about what the use is on the property that would necessitate the need for additional driveways in rural areas. There was a lot of discussion about and support for the consideration of function of state highways and a recognition that function matters when it comes to how we view access and permit access to state highways. And so we use the existing definition of the classification of highways that exists in the Oregon Highway Plan to distinguish between what I'm going to say is as a lower level of importance route from a statewide mobility perspective and a higher level of importance route, again, from a statewide mobility perspective. And we tiered the standards such that, you know, if you're in a urban area where it's a lower classification route, such as a district-level route that serves more of a local function than a statewide mobility function, the standard for access to those types of routes would be less than if you're on a statewide classification route where there's an expectation that mobility is important, therefore we want to manage and reduce congestion as much as possible. We maintain a higher standard. And so there was that recognition that function matters, and we tiered the standards such that we could accommodate that. We spent a lot of time talking about change of use conditions. Change of use is where you've got an existing business with a permitted driveway onto a state highway. You might want to do a business. You want to do an expansion to your business or make an improvement to your business. Today's rules would say that we have the ability to ask you what the traffic impacts to your permitted driveway would be as a result of those improvements, that expansion plan that you have. And if it breached a certain threshold, we would require you to come and reapply for your permit for your approach, which could look a lot different today than what it did when you applied for the permit originally, because obviously conditions change and the standards change for those applications for those types of things. And so so the earlier legislation, Senate Bill 1024, basically doubled the threshold, which made it easier for businesses to look at expanding without having to come back and reapply for their permit. So again, the idea was to reduce the impact, the burden on businesses that want to make improvements to their property that will bring jobs or bring business to the community. We talked a lot about our dispute resolution process, and there were concerns about how we've administered issues and disputes under the current rule that led to the formation of what's been referred to as a dispute review board under Senate Bill 264, and that would be the formation of a board that includes someone from the local government, someone from the business community, such as a chamber or you know, a business associate similar to that that's applied for an application for a driveway, a traffic engineer, and then a representative from ODOT that would be the region manager. And the idea is to form a group that would provide a little broader perspective on not so much on whether we're following our own rules, such as what exists today in the current rule in our dispute review process, but instead whether we're seeking that right balance, as the director said, between how we manage the traffic safety and operations of the highway with the importance and merits of business opportunities on those properties that abut the state highway. So it'd be a board that would provide that broader insight as to whether we're at the right place in terms of managing that balance between those things. There's a lot of work yet to be done with this legislation, with the work that's been done through our stakeholder committee over the past 12 months. We are right now putting pieces in place that would revise our administrative rules to reflect these changes. Certainly, as this language takes form in statute, it brings even more prominence to the need to affect our administrative rules today and how we so that it complements this work. But we've also got, in addition to the rulemaking process that we'll be engaging in to reflect these changes, we also flagged a number of items with our Access Management Committee that we just weren't able to get to as part of within the timeline necessary to bring this work here today. And so those items that have been flagged, we committed to pulling the Access Management Committee back together and continuing to work on those items as well. And to assist us in that ongoing work, one of the final provisions in Senate Bill 264 was the formation of an Access Management Legislative Oversight Task Force that would enable us to engage as necessary at a legislative level and work between our stakeholder committee and the department to make further changes as those take form as we move forward. So with that, I will see if there's any questions.
I imagine there will be. Just a very basic one for me that hopefully would be a quick answer. Could you give me just one sort of prototypical, if there is such a thing, example of a circumstance that this bill would help solve or make more easily managed?
Well, I don't know that there's a prototype. I think just about every application today, the process today is based on an engineering analysis of every application that comes in. In other words, we don't have the ability for an applicant to come in with any sort of certainty, knowing whether or not they might likely get a driveway approved until we do that work. With the formation of these standards, it enables an applicant or a property owner or developer to fairly easily look and see if they were going to be able to comply with the standards before they invest any money at all. And have some level of certainty at a far less cost and reduced time frame as to whether they're going to get a driveway. And that pretty much applies to all applications today. Certainly those smaller ones would be the ones that are most impacted, because the idea was to, again, reduce the burden on the smaller developments, small businesses that need a driveway, would like to have a driveway, and, you know, so rather than having to go out and hire a traffic engineer to fill out the application, we've got these standards in place that would enable them to much more easily determine whether or not it's plausible or not.
Thank you.
I think, Mr. Chair, if I may,
please.
Again, the continuity of the way we administer the permit. There was a significant critique that out in Central Oregon may be treated a little bit differently than you were in Southern Oregon or from the Portland metro area. So there's a continuity. Again, objective standards. You believe you meet these or not. And you know going in with some level of certainty that you can move forward. Also, what we think we've done here is we've taken roughly 80% of the challenges that we face that would eventually run through a deviation process, which takes time, which frustrates folks because business wants to move very quickly. We've taken those off the table because now you know through objective standards whether you meet it or not, and we can turn things around much quicker.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that much quicker piece, did I see in here someplace some specific standards on how quickly one has to respond? Is that in here? Maybe I'm confusing with another bill.
No, you saw that there are some time requirements that have been included in the legislation, not too unlike what we have today, that gives the agency and the applicant certain time frames for submitting and reviewing an application and getting an answer back on that. In addition, I'm sorry.
Follow up. And I'm just reflecting back on other timeline situations in other departments, and what would happen is if the department couldn't meet the timeline, they'd simply deny the permit. You could start over again. In this instance, or mainly, and that was driven in large part by not having sufficient staff. So I'm just curious if this is going to drive a need for more staff.
It will not drive a need for more staff, but the issue that you raise is a real issue, in that it does place more responsibility on the agency to do the engineering analysis if we do anticipate a safety issue than what we had before. And so there will be added workload that agency staff will absorb that didn't exist before, that was the responsibility of the applicant prior to this work. But at this point, we think we're going to be able to do that, absorb that within existing staff.
shift parts of the bill. I've noticed in helping folks try to work through the current access management process that there was a unfortunate interaction between local planning folks and ODOT, where there is kind of a, well, you have the zone change, but you've got to close off some access or do other things like that. Does this bill address that issue?
Not specifically, indirectly. I think how I'd respond to that is that by establishing these standards, and certainly by securing them in statute, it clarifies what the expectations are for the decision criteria for approving an approach to a state highway, even in a within an urban growth boundary that may have their own ordinances for managing access to major arterials. So it does, you know, create a bit of a dichotomy there between how we manage under these rules and under this legislation access to those state highways. That looks different than how a local government or local jurisdiction would be managing access to a similar type route, but only under their own jurisdiction within a community. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that this enjoyed a unanimous support in the Senate, but it also appears that it was amended. Was there an amendment, or is this it? Was the product of all that work brought to the Senate and emerged unscathed, or has it been?
I think there was an amendment or two, but mostly technical corrections. I mean, we didn't see drastic changes. Again, all the effort that went into date pretty much placed us in the pathway that we see today.
Right. Follow up, and I would just say that having been peripherally involved in the process, it was an amazing amount of work, and the product from modest understanding of it appears to be excellent, but of course, time will tell. And having worked my way through a series of different access issues, I understand the difficulty and the balancing that you were talking about. So I look forward to seeing this work.
I probably should let that lie because I appreciate that statement, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Benz. The reality is, this was a very healthy and at times robust conversation with us, but it was collaborative. Again, there was an outcome we were seeking. Everyone sitting around the table, like I say, the two dozen folks that made up the committee, and there was a core group of folks that were there day in and day out at times to arrive where we are. We've also put in some fail-safes. Again, the dispute resolution board, a collaborative forum where we try to find a remedy, and then a legislative task force that will oversee these activities, because I'm sure there are things that, we're playing the game on paper here, and it will look a little bit different when we play it on the ground. That said, whoever makes up this oversight board will be able to react to what's happening here in addition to anything your constituents may bring to you. So we, as Mr. Bryant said, this is an ongoing journey, no doubt.
No doubt. Thank you. Further questions? Don't see any. We have a few more people who want to testify. Thank you for being here, and please don't go anywhere. We might come up with more questions.
Sure.
Mark Whitlow, Craig Honeyman, David Barenberg. I see Mr. Barenberg coming forward, so it's up to you two. Go ahead, Mr. Whitlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Whitlow, and I'm a land use attorney with Perkins Coie, but I'm here on behalf of the International Council of Shopping Centers, ICSE, and the Retail Task Force. So I sat on the Access Management Committee that has just been described to you on behalf of those interests, so I was one of the participants from the private sector. I'd like to thank Director Garrett and Mr. Bryant for making all this possible, both from the inception, but also through the detailed work that we've done at the committee level. I think their overview to you in terms of policy and technical aspects was excellent, so I'm not going to repeat that, but I would summarize by saying this bill then simplifies, streamlines, and makes more efficient the process for granting access to the highway and makes more objective the criteria. So those things put together then would enhance economic development by making it more clear if access is achievable, making it quicker to obtain it, cutting out a lot of the fuss and bother that has been historically part of that process. So in essence, then it's good for the abutting property owners, the intended users of the highway for access, along with others. But it's good for the department, who are the stewards of the highway, and therefore it's good for the state, because none of this work would impinge upon safety or highway operations. And so those points were made, but they're important points, and we want to reiterate them. We're all aware of the need for safety and for good functionality. So I think what you've seen is the creation of a better process. It actually enhances collaboration between the parties. If the department, for instance, thinks it's going to have to recommend a denial or put, impose conditions, under the new rules, it would telegraph that to the applicant and give them the opportunity to sit down up front as part of the permitting process and engage in a collaborative discussion that previously was only available after the fact in the appellate process. So that's an example of how, you know, we've agreed to work together better, to come up with a better product quicker, to allow properties that are adjacent to the highway to redevelop. So, in essence, it's good for the economic development needs of the state, which we all need, know are our number one priority. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from the panel, and then we'll see if there are questions. Mr. Honeyman.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director of League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to summarize some remarks that are being handed out to you. First of all, let me say up front, we are here in support of Senate Bill 264A that arose from Senate Bill 1024 from the last for the February session. That's previously been described to you. I'm not going to kid you, when we first started in this process, we had concerns about codifying what had heretofore been a sort of a regulatory and more of a negotiated process, but we also understand the need for certainty, the timelines, and the objectivity, and we believe this bill has accomplished that very well. We also, frankly, had some concerns about issues relating to cities sort of faced a conundrum about safety, about throughput, about congestion, if you will, but we also need and want economic development. So, again, I think a balance has been struck in this legislation that allows us together to accomplish all of the above. We like certain things that we like about the bill. We like the certainty for our partners in the, on the economic development side. We like the flexibility. We we appreciate the fact that this legislation has built in a process, collaborative process, whereby a one-size-fits-all approach will not always be applied, that there's a good balance struck between the need for objective and clear standards as well as the opportunity for applicants to seek deviations through a fact-based collaboration with ODOT. ODOT described to you the dispute review board process. Local governments are assured of a seat on those boards in the area where the dispute might occur. We appreciate that. Jurisdictional transfer is always a tool. It's been used in the past, can be used again in this process. 264A, for the first time, I think, provides for the opportunity for local jurisdictions and ODOT to actually negotiate, in the context of a jurisdictional transfer, an ongoing maintenance agreement that would assure funding for roads that ODOT abandons through that process. And then finally, we appreciate the fact that there are two seats on the ongoing Access Management Oversight Task Force dedicated to local governments, and we would intend to be a full partner in that process going forward as well. So with that, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Mr. Barenberg, thanks for your written testimony. I wanted to highlight the fact that you've given my co-chair and I a new title. I didn't know about co-chairs, but appreciate you being here.
Mr. Cocharis,
or maybe it's Charis, I don't know.
I'm Dave Barenberg from the City of Portland, and as always, we are innovating. thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I just want to really reiterate what has been said before me. This was a task force process that worked. People came to the table and worked very diligently, listened to one another, and came up with a result that works for Oregon and works for all the parties that were at the table. Our party that was at the table, Portland, had a city engineer or transportation engineer as part of the work group, also representing representing cities in general. And she sends her apologies for not being here, but wanted me to convey that she thinks this is a major advance for our highway and street network. Saying street network is an important component because what this bill does is it recognizes the interplay between the state highway system and local roads, as well as the businesses and people that front on these roads. So this bill provides a more transparent process, a simpler process for local governments in doing work on our street system that that intersects with the state system, provides flexibility, improves the application process, and then also advances the jurisdictional transfer process by allowing ongoing commitments of revenue. We think this is a good bill, and we really appreciate the efforts of all the parties that came to the table on this, and particularly the leadership of ODOT on this issue. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Whitlow, thanks for your testimony today. And I'm going to read off of this because my computer just died on me. Under Section 5 of the engrossed version, specifically Subsection 4, there's some new language under there. It's the second to the last sentence that says, Subsection 3B of this section shall be based on the economic development needs of the property abutting the highway for its authorized and planned uses. Then there's the important language, subject only to consideration of safety and highway operations. My question is just to make it explicitly clear in the intent here, nothing in this section here limits the department's authority to acquire abutting rights of access by agreement, donation, or exercise of the power eminent domain, correct?
Oh, Mr. Chair and Representative Lindsay, that's correct. There would be no change at all with respect to what would happen for acquisition of rights of access, either by agreement or in condemnation. The bill, it would be neutral. In fact, no change at all in those processes.
Great. And a follow-up? Sure. Nothing, nor is there anything in the section that limits the right of a person to bring, and I think you just said it, an action in circuit court seeking compensation for taking the abutting rights.
That would be correct. The bill would be neutral on that as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This builds on Representative Lindsay's question, but I've seen in situations where there are points of access someone might acquire when they purchase a piece of property. They'll maybe have two existing points of access, and they're told this by ODOT at the time they acquire the property. You've got this access, and it's a pretty big deal. Does this bill do anything to upset the status quo when it comes to those types of arrangements? That's kind of a starting point for the question. The broader, moving back away from a question, would be if you look at this effort, is it one that moves away from restriction and thus away from, I hate to say, safety, because that seemed to be the competing points, and just in general. First is very specific, and I'm assuming the answer is no, it doesn't affect status quo. But the broader question is, are we less safe as a result of this bill, or in your opinion, was the balance maintained, and all we've really done is make it easier to get to that ultimate decision of safety versus economics?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, I think the better balance is to allow us to gain efficiency for getting to the issue that's most important, to grant access where we meet the standards subject to safety and highway operations, which then ODOT can come as the steward of the highway with the information and raise. So in a specific way, it's better than the status quo because it allows property owners to grow businesses without being stuck with the access, well, without losing access that they previously had, just because they're changing their business. So it's a more thoughtful process, I guess is the better answer. And it asks ODOT to look at things from the perspective of the abutting owner, which previously wasn't the perspective that ODOT brought to the table. So I think we've improved our ability to communicate in terms of the things that are important. From the highway's perspective, safety and functionality still remain important. But those concepts were overshadowing the economic development needs of the abutting property owners. So all we've done is sharpen our focus on when safety and operations enter into the equation for permitting. So it's a better process. It doesn't undermine safety or functionality. It simply makes it more objective to identify when those circumstances exist that would work against issuing another approach permit. But we found in the past that because of the lack of clarity of what safety consisted of or what highway operations were applicable, that permits were not being granted that should have been granted. So it's removed the handcuffs from the process.
Right. I think I follow you. The default, of course, always would have been safety. The hope is that the bill refines that analysis that makes the both goals more achievable.
And by shifting the burden from the applicant to the department that has the information, the department in most cases will have built the highway and designed, engineered, built, and will know all of the functionality elements and the crash histories. So they have the information, and therefore they're the best ones to say that this isn't safe, but from a specific set of circumstances that now have been identified. So as others have testified, the process is more transparent. By being able to see better, all of us, what the real issues are, we can, you know, cut to the chase and let a lot of permits be approved faster than they would have been, without saying you have to approve a permit application that isn't safe or that would undermine highway functionality.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 264. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill?
Yes.
I don't see anyone. Some expressions of disappointment in the audience. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 264. And, Mr. Cocho, do you think we're ready?
I think we are ready, yes.
Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 264. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 264A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved Senate Bill 264A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I don't see any. Is there any objection?
No objection from my part. I'm good with it.
Thank you for making that clear. Without objection, then, and noting that Representative Smith is excused, the motion passes, and Senate Bill 264 heads to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Benz, given that you've been involved, would you like to carry?
Sure.
Representative Benz will carry. Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 264 and open a work session on Senate Bill 437. Zach.
Senate Bill 437 expands public records disclosure exemption to records, communication, and information received by counties and cities in connection with applications for economic development monies, support, or assistance.
Thank you. We heard this bill some time ago. Had some good discussion on it. Don't think we have any amendments. We have all the paperwork that's ready to go, unless there is more discussion to be had. I know there are some people who are interested in the bill who are here if we had questions or other discussion we want to have.
MTA amendments.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I was busy reading something else.
No problem. Senate Bill 437, we don't have any amendments. We have the paperwork, and no one seems interested in further discussion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 437 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz says move Senate Bill 437 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of the motion?
Could you remind me which one this is?
It is the second one on our agenda. You should have the...
yeah, I don't have it. My computer went out.
Okay. It has to do with the confidentiality of records around economic development.
Okay, thank you. No discussion.
No discussion. Any objection to the motion? I don't see any. And the motion carries with the note that Representative Smith is excused. And Senate Bill 437 heads the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there anyone who would like to carry the bill? I can carry it.
Yeah.
I want to carry the bill, the digital billboards one.
I'll carry Senate Bill 437. We'll see how 639 goes. Close the work session on Senate Bill 437 and open a work session on Senate Bill 639. Zach, if you could remind us of that one quickly.
Senate Bill 639 creates the definition of a digital billboard. We also have the dash 8 and dash 9 amendments in front of us.
Thank you. So my intention with the committee's approval would be to invite some people forward to discuss the options that are in front of us in the form of the two amendments. I understand there may be some additional ones forthcoming. We don't have the paperwork to move any of them forward, but given that our time in which we could do that is closing, I thought it would be worthwhile for us to have some discussion about the options that are presented here. Some different things that are addressed in each of them, and we can see how the discussion goes. So it might start with the dash 8s. Those are ones that I had some involvement in creating. And now we have the dash 10s. In front of us. Are you passing those out to the rest of the committee? Well, okay, so dash 10s are also in front of us. I'm seeing them for the first time. I've not had for those.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wagner.
The dash 10s are mine. We had made some changes because there were some concerns that a couple members had, so I had made those changes for the dash 10s. So the dash 9s were mine, and okay, Now they're the dash 10s, and it just had to do with setting the limit on what a lease agreement would be.
Okay.
This way it leaves it open between the landowner and the property owner, so or the sign carrier and the property owner.
For the immediate future, we can essentially discard 9 and
yep,
focus on 10? Okay. So dash 8s and dash 10s. And I wonder if Mr. Barrows, either of Mr. Barrows, would be one to come forward and walk us through some of the components of dash 8s. Someone you'd like to bring with you?
Mr. Barrows.
Mr. Barrows and Mr. Barrows, that's fine. But while you're getting settled, I'll take the opportunity to thank you for the conversation we've had. Obviously, your clients, Clear Channel, have been among the more active and interested in digital billboards, and appreciated your willingness to talk about some of the things that are contained here. So I'll let you guys take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dave Barrows, representing Clear Channel Outdoor. We only received the dash 8s in the last 2-3 hours. They have been disseminated amongst the appropriate people inside the corporation. They're looking at them. I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, that a question was raised on a conference call about whether or not, and this is a Heidi Elliott question, whether or not...
The benefit of the committee, that's our drafter in Legislative Council.
Yes. Whether or not on page 2, the 10% of the dividing line between, in essence, to make it simple, the big ones and the non-big ones, and whether or not that passes constitutional muster under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. I don't know. For those of you who know, I have a ticket to practice law, but nobody should be confused by that, that I could actually do it. I just want to raise that. I'm not saying we're backing away or anything. I'm just saying that question was raised. Other than that, I would say, Mr. Chairman, the amendments at first blush appear to reflect the conversations we've had with you and are not other than what we talked about.
So would you like to talk about the components, or I can try to do some of that, but
I'd be happy to. Or
let's do that, please.
About the distinction between the bigs and little.
Oh no!
Oh,
no.
Sorry.
Just generally, what's in these amendments?
Okay.
And how it would how it would work.
Yeah. As opposed to the original bill, in the first on page one in the at top of the area lines 4 through 20, or I guess 9. There was a provision in the original bill that said that by rule the Department of Transportation would determine how what the light could be, how bright the light could be from the sign, depending on the size of the sign and so forth. We suggested that the national standards, the ones that are adopted in most states, be used, and the department agreed that was a better way to proceed. They preferred that. And we talked to you about that, Mr. Chairman, and so hopefully that stays put. There's also the question of what kind of power these signs would be run by, and that's the bottom of page one of the Dash 8 amendments. And we have no heartburn with that. It just says use renewable energy resources as specified when it's possible. And this is not an unusual thing. In some states, they've done it with both solar and with wind. Now, Florida uses solar some. Why not? Other states have used wind. Whether or not it makes sense to do it exclusively with that kind of power, that's a question. And we all know the whole question of the grid and whether when wind doesn't blow, what happens, and too much water goes over the dams, and all that stuff. But we're fine with this language. Top page 2 in section 6, we define what a large billboard is, called a bulletin, and then a somewhat smaller billboard is, which is called a poster. These are terms inside the industry, but it's also now would be in the statute. And then it goes on to say that if a person has less than 10% of the relocation credits currently in the relocation bank, of which there are 796, these are permits of signs that have been taken down for whatever reason, and that permit then sits on a list at ODOT. Two companies would not fall into subsection A. Subsection A would say that if a person wants to build a digital billboard and they are a small company, they would have to remove an existing outdoor sign and turn in the permit or turn in one relocation credit. Sub B is for the larger companies, and they would have to, in order to get a digital permit, sign permit, they would have to remove two existing bulletins, large ones, and turn those in, and plus three relocation credits, or they could remove one existing bulletin, big one, and two posters, smaller billboards, and three relocation credits, or they could do tear down four poster size signs, and if I said turn in on with one bulletin and two posters, I meant to say they take those down. Mm-hmm. So it'd be two bulletins, or one bulletin and two posters, or four posters, plus three location credits in order to get a digital billboard sign under these amendments. If we do a back-to-back sign, which is not unheard of in the industry, you double everything, whether it's for a small company or a big company.
But to be clear on that, a digital billboard is a single face, and a back-to-back is two digital.
Two or do a V like you do out at the Volcano Stadium. They have a V signs. The department would then issue a one digital relocation credit for any digital billboard that is taken down, and it could be reconstructed somewhere else.
Yes.
Section 7 talks about an attempt to...
And one other thing on that, this on top of page 3 also, it's worth mentioning, there's a possibility of having a digital poster. And there's a separate...
Yes, I'm sorry. You're absolutely right, Mr. Chairman. That's exactly right. And that's two posters and three relocation credits if you're a big guy.
Right.
Of which there are only two companies. Section 7 is...
just a question. You're representing
I'm sorry.
That's okay. A reminder to me. On the relocation credits, are those particular to size? Or is a relocation credit just a relocation credit? So would it be different for a poster and a...
I believe, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, if I may turn and see what my client's head is doing, whether it's going this way or that way.
It's not moving at the moment, but you certainly may turn.
Thank you.
I understand.
the correct way.
Well, we might, and Mr. President, we might ask, I'm sure Amy Joyce is going to, her heart is going to sink when I ask this, but maybe you'd like to join us here and
Terry,
be sort of a standby.
Oh,
I was asking Amy if she might like to help us with these questions. So Amy Joyce with the Department of Transportation who has
she would know,
worked
yeah,
on,
the direct
on signs
for, sure.
for a long time.
Chair Reed, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Relocation credits are size specific.
Okay.
And they're also location specific, right? So that you can't, there's a radius in which they are eligible and outside of which they would not work?
Chair Reed, that's correct. There's a 100 road miles from its location is where it can be relocated to. One of the provisions is that once you aggregate all these permits and credits together to come up with a digital, that 100 mile rule does not apply the very first time you build that digital, and then thereafter. After it does apply. That's another provision in the Dash 8.
Only the first time.
Okay. Representative Smith?
Is that a 100-mile radius or a 100-mile box in which it's split in the center?
Chair Reed, Representative Smith, it is 100 road miles. So in our office, we pull out a map and we go along the highways.
If you can drive
roads.
100 miles, so it's a rough radius, but it's probably a little bit less than that because you'd have to take some turns.
Chair Reed, Representative Smith, correct.
Got it.
Please go ahead. At the top of page 4, this is something we've worked on. As I think all of you know, the outdoor advertising business has been for many years, well, for its existence, a donor of public service announcements for nonprofits, for law enforcement, those kind of things. And we would continue that. Using digital, which would be a great boon, actually, especially in the law enforcement area. And this is a language that the chair asks us to work on and agree to that kind of formalizes that process about how do people come to the industry and get PSAs. And have a system. And I will tell you, in the case of emergency and Amber Alert, there are formal agreements all over the country about how that works. And so this is very much in line with that. Then the chair, you might actually probably better explain the Section 8, Mr. Chairman, than this is your idea.
Absolutely. So Section 8 asks the Travel Information Council to do some work on how that the content of Section 7 might be made even more formal. No reason to suspect that it might change otherwise, but in large part, we're depending on the continued goodwill of the outdoor advertising companies in making that inventory, if I'm not using the wrong term, available for these public purposes.
And there's some questions about how to best prioritize those things, about how to consider making that a more formal process. The Tribal Information Council is very interested in being involved and having that conversation. So that's there to formalize that process, and they could come back with recommendations to a future legislature about how that that might be improved. And that's basically the dash eights, I think. So eight questions on dash eights before we get, but we can ask about the dash tens as well. Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Curious on here, and this came over from the Senate. It's just, we want digital billboards, and I'm in favor of digital billboards. I think that's a great idea. And as I'm reading the amendments, it says that we have to tear down all these other billboards. I don't get the policy objective there. What was the thinking behind swapping out all these? I don't get it.
I can speak for myself on this, and I will try not to veer into too much of my own history, but billboards were not the thing that was foremost in my mind when I came to the legislature, but I had the relatively good fortune, thanks to my predecessor as chair of the Transportation Committee, to serve on a billboard task force. The system that we have regulating billboards is a function of the federal legislation in the 50s. The Highway Beautification Act is associated with Lady Bird Johnson. It worked fine in Oregon until a Supreme Court case in 2006, I think, that alleged that our system of regulation amounted to restriction based on content. That throughout that system, but in order to be in compliance with federal law and continue to receive our federal highway dollars, we had to establish a new system of regulation. That's when I came into the story, and what I learned was that our system is based on a cap. So in the 50s, when we were coming into compliance with the federal requirement to have a system of regulation, we established a cap that said no more than this, and that's what gave rise to the bank. That has been, I think, sort of a characteristic of our system of regulating outdoor signs throughout. There are significant numbers and organizations who feel very strongly that we should have less billboards in the state as an aesthetic and that sort of thing. The Garden Club is one example of that. Some other variety of environmental, environmentally centered organizations, and so on. So my intent in trying to craft something that works and has the support of at least one a member of the industry is to balance that, because on the one hand there are significant benefits to digital as you've outlined and clearly see, but there. In doing so, there is a certain amount of balance, and there is probably additional revenue and additional flexibility in what can be displayed on those billboards. So if you think about the fact that there might be, I think there's 5 to 7 to 8, something like that, as they flip per minute. So in some respects, it might be equivalent to having that many more signs in place in some sense in terms of the content that's delivered. So
are you concerned about a legal challenge from the government on the cap? Are we saying that there are really 8 billboards inside the one?
I'm not making a case about the legal part of it. I'm just making a political case and sort of how can we balance those things. So there's certainly room to disagree, and I wouldn't begrudge you that, but that's some of the thinking that's led us to this place.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Representative Lindsay.
I announced a little while ago that I was going to Vegas, and I just got back from Vegas.
Are you really going to talk about what happened in Vegas?
I am.
Okay, he's Mormon.
Right. I am. Right. Yeah, there's two things. Mormons take $10 and the Ten Commandments of Vegas, and we don't break either one of them. So we're not that
friendly. You said that before.
So this is my question, though. So I got back from Vegas. Billboards everywhere. I've been to several other states. Oregon, compared to every other state that I have been in, has hardly any billboards, hardly any, especially compared to other states. And we want to cap them even further. I guess I'd like to just, to me this appears to be nothing more than we'll give you a digital billboard if we get rid of some of the very few billboards that we have already. Can you...
I think that's right. I think that there are a significant number of people in Oregon who would accept your description or your difference, your description of the difference between Las Vegas and Oregon and say they like that.
Yeah, I guess my response is that what we have right now, I don't know if we're at the cap or not, but what we have right now, let's keep the status quo, just allow digital billboards.
Well, we're not at the cap because what is in the bank. There, as you've heard, there are restrictions based on size and based on location of what's in the bank. But that cap has been in place. It goes up and down.
Let's go to the cap then, and then we can cut them down. This is essentially lowering the cap. What's a federal mandate already?
I don't think it's lowering the cap. It would be the decision of the owners of the credits whether they wanted to trade them for digital. There's no obligation that they have to. So I think
that's right. Objective. But to go to a better system of digital billboard, which has all these benefits, if they want to go there, which I think environmentalists would like, I think it's environmentally friendly. It's at the expense of taking down. So it does cost something. It does cost something. Keep up. And actually, I think that we'd support this as well because if people have to take them down to put up a digital billboard, they might just choose to keep up all the I won't say it, but to keep up the less efficient, more environmentally damaging products up because that's better to have more numbers than less with a more environmentally friendly way.
Yep.
You disagree?
I think I do, but that's fine for the moment.
Okay.
Representative Smith.
Thanks. And I want to applaud the chair. I still have concerns with the with various pieces, but I want to applaud the chair on the work on the bill and give one thought of trying to reach sort of a policy balance. Maybe it's just a political balance, but I think it's a policy balance. There are various questions, I think, of moving forward on digital billboards. One, we don't have the results of the federal study. Two, is a question I want to ask you guys about that I don't have an answer to, so I won't opine on yet. Three is there right now are unused credits that if we allow digital billboards, you might have, I think it's very, very likely, you have places right now that don't make a lot of economic sense to have a billboard, but might make economic sense to have a digital billboard. That's good news in many respects, right? It allows somebody to get a revenue stream that otherwise might not get it or might not get as big a one. It would also move us in the direction of Vegas, which might, different people can, argue with the benefits or costs of that. And I think in trying to find a balance to say, okay, well, if we're going to do this and create an additional likelihood of more signs on our roads to balance that ever so slightly with a little bit of a trade-in, I think that's laudable. And again, I totally understand why folks might disagree, but I applaud the chair for his work on that. I do have a question. I have not delved into this as deeply as the co-chair. Unfortunately, have delved into it a little bit over the last couple of weeks. As I understand it, currently there's a minimum space between signs on state highways, like Highway 8 and Highway 99. So you can be as little as 100 feet apart, and you can be directly at an intersection. Right. So you don't have to be spaced away from the intersection; you can be at the intersection. Those regulations were put in, I think, when digital billboards were not contemplated. I don't think they existed. And without consideration of signage that didn't change its message every 8 to 10 seconds. What do we know? Do we have anything in any of our amendments that addresses the spacing required either in between signs or from intersections on outdoor advertising signs with regard to the safety stuff?
Chair Reed, Representative Smith, there is Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. There is nothing in any of the amendments or the base bill changing any of the spacing requirements from what exists today in the law. So you're correct. There are some highways on the system where the minimum spacing is 100 feet within a city limits, 500 feet outside of city limits. And no restrictions at intersections. On interstates and freeways, the spacing and intersection rule is different. Spacing on interstates is 2,000 feet between signs outside of city limits, 500 feet within city limits, and outside of city limits, you cannot be within or within 500 feet of an interchange. So there are some restrictions there in the current law, but nothing in any amendment I have seen or in the base bill makes any changes to the spacing requirements relative to digital.
It's also worth noting, Representative Smith, that it's nothing prevents cities from enacting more strict spacing requirements.
Quick question, follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
Question on that. I really don't know, the Highway 8, Highway 9, you know, state highways, are cities, what discretion do cities have to control state highways within their city? Full discretion, or is there any limits to that discretion?
Chair Reed and Representative Smith, the cities and counties can enact sign codes or ordinances that are more restrictive than the state law.
Got it. Thank you.
Other questions?
Go ahead. I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, and they have.
Sure.
Representative Sheehan.
I think the chair had his hand up first.
Didn't see it.
Thank you. Chairs, huh? What's the reason for having a cutoff where if you have 10% or less of the total number of relocation credits, they have to swap out a sign for a sign, but if you have more than that, you have this equation of swapping out a handful of signs and a handful of relocation credits. If the objective is to remove signs from the highway, I don't get why there's that change from like small business to big business. Is that what we're talking about?
I think that is one of the concerns. Looking for my notes here, somewhere I wrote down 796, I think, was the number you used of total credits, and there are only two companies who have more than 10%. So the thought was to try to balance again some of that, and I'm sure I can be corrected if I get this wrong. That, as I understand the history of the industry, it has become consolidated over a number of years from a much greater number of companies who had a smaller portion of the market into a smaller number of companies who had a larger portion. So the thought here is to try to give those companies that are small a sort of proportionate chance to enter this market if they choose to do so. So there are others who will, I think, be coming before us who will be in a better position to answer that more articulately than I, but that's one thought about it. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. First, as a comment to the exchanges on the swapping out of signs, I would just point out that, draw people's attention to the last page of the bill, which talks about the tri-vision signs, and down the line 2024 subset 6 and 7. So this concept of swapping out signs in exchange for a sign that shows more faces is an existing one. It's not a new concept. And when this issue came up, I thought that the industry would be most likely the one to look to see if they would accept what was being proposed by the co-chair, and the industry seems to have accepted it. So I look to you guys for that. The pros and cons of the debate we're now having, we should like to hear from you. But it does appear to be consistent with the past. Here's my question. I don't know what the phrase turn in means as it's used on page 2 of the dash 8. It says remove two existing bulletins and turn in the permits. What is there some magic to that phrase, turn in? If we turn them in, do they suddenly disappear? Or do they languish there for someone else to grab? What does turn in mean?
Co-Chair Reed and Co-Chair Bentz, there's no magic to that language. It becomes somewhat difficult under the current, the underlying rubric of the system, which is you either reconstruct an existing sign or, quote, relocate a sign, which is really a euphemism for tearing down a sign in one place and getting a permit to build a brand new sign someplace else. You don't truly relocate an existing sign. So then you get into the issue of when you're going to have these multiple credits and permits, do you, quote, reconstruct them? Do you, quote, relocate them? What you're really doing is sort of turning them in, turning them over to the department to be permanently canceled, not go into the bank, not go onto some other sign, but they are sort of turned in and out of this grouping of permits and credits under the matrix. You come up with one brand new digital permit, but there's no magic to that language.
Follow. The magic was that indeed they are canceled. That's what my question was. To turn in means to cancel.
co-chairs, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. And then on the first page, I have thought that from the start that the switch out of our existing signs to the digital sign, the greatest challenge would be for the neighbors around it. And that takes me to the new language, which actually spells out the number of feet at which the 0.3 foot candles would be measured. And that's what we see now, the 150, 200, 250, depending upon the size of the sign. The standard that I understand, the picture I have in my mind, given past testimony, is that whichever of the size of these signs, it wouldn't be different than a sign we currently have as it would look lit at night. And I have I don't know what point 0.3 foot candles is. Am I correct in that understanding of the brightness of the new digital sign? Is it the equivalent of what we would see if we put these lights on it at night?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Tom Barrows representing Clear Channel Outdoor. Indications from my client in the back of the room are that is correct.
I'm not sure the standard that's being established here by the client in the back of the room, but I'm just saying that, I'm just asking, when we think of 0.3, and my constituents call me and say, my goodness, we now have something that looks like Las Vegas, where before we had a modest little sign, am I going to be safe in saying, gee, it's just exactly the same? You shouldn't notice any difference.
Mr. Sandblast, would you like to come up and have a seat and give us your thought on this? And please start with your name, too.
Mr. Co-Chair Reed and Co-Chair Bench, my name is Terry Sandblast. I'm with Clear Channel Outdoor, and the answer to your question is the digital sign at night, it would be equal or less to than the existing sign at night. In terms of the brilliance. We've seen that at different locations throughout the country, and it's obvious that when you photograph those in terms of a video, you really don't notice the difference. And so that's the answer that I have for that.
Mr. Barrett? Could I amplify? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair. These also have, what's the term I want?
Dimmer switches.
Yeah, switches. That measure ambient light, and if it becomes brighter than 50, I think it's the bill says 50 candle power or something, which I have no idea what that means, but it seems to be the standard. Brighter than the ambient light, the board either goes black or turns off automatically. And so unlike a normal sign, somebody has to call somebody and they have to drive out there and do something. The sign does it itself.
Paul, sure. Please. And I noticed that, indeed, it does say that the statute does call out the fact that it will be exactly as you've just said,
yes.
Mr. Barrow. So that's comforting. I did contact land use planners in my district to ask if one of these new signs would require a land use, would still be a use such as the one that currently allows the current sign to exist, and I've not yet heard back from them, but maybe perhaps you as a company already looked into this, and I just wonder if you'll be able to change these signs out without going through a land use planning exercise.
Well, my response to that, Chair Benz, would be that each jurisdiction would be different in terms of how it regulates the issuance of a permit. If a jurisdiction required a land use review, for example, you would certainly have to go through that. I would assume their regulations would require that for a change of type of sign. I mean, that's an assumption, but from my history, that's generally the way things work.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we have Amy here, our expert, and we're talking land use and some different things like that.
And we're going to get to your amendments, too. So,
I was thinking since we didn't, or do we want Amy to come up several times?
I think she can stay, hopefully. I hope she can stay for those, too. And I don't mean to cut you off at all, but just to be clear, we're going to get to yours, too. So if you want to
okay. I was just going to get a few because we're kind of going into that area with the credits.
Sure. So let me just ask quickly if there are any other questions on dash 8s and
if not, we can go directly to dash 10s, give you a chance to set the stage with those and where you're trying to go, and then ask a question. So looks like no other questions on dash 8. So thank you. Oh, Representative Smith?
Yeah, I apologize, Mr. Chair.
it wouldn't be a hearing without me about to
I better. I get buyer's remorse.
It's not very kind to our co-vice chair, but...
So I see the exemption. So I really like the piece about buyer's remorse. I didn't get it at first. I was like, what's she selling?
I will say she has lots of it.
Yeah, okay. They're all wonderful people. See the exemption. So very much applaud trying to alleviate one of the challenges of these and make them focused on, make them use renewable energy. I think that's great. Do have a question for you, Amy, on is there any, I drive, as we all have probably, drive to 84, see lots and lots and lots of windmills on the side. I've never gotten an accident on 84. Is there any reason we should be concerned about the exemption in F sub G? The F sub 6, I guess. It's just sub G on having, I don't know if I'm allowed to use visual aid. Permission to use visual aid?
You don't need my permission. Go ahead.
Having a windmill on top of one of the signs. Is there any reason why this? I mean, I know that one of the big things that they've been working on, the Clear Channel in the game, been working on, is say these aren't going to be moving kind of digital signs. These aren't going to have, Joe Campbell putting the cigarette to his mouth. It's going to be just, sort of stable and normal. Is there any worry that we have movable parts, with just like a windmill?
Chair Reed and Representative Smith, the visual aid that you held up and the pictures that I have seen of windmills that are attached to billboards are quite small. So I think, the provision in the law prohibiting moving parts, I think, goes back to the day when signs were very clever and had character and moved and were quite charming. And this is, I think, a different thing. And, I don't see it as being a huge cool distraction problem.
Thank you.
Representative Ryder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to kind of expound on what Representative Smith was touching on earlier when he was getting into the spacing, we haven't really defined any boundaries for the digital billboards. And when he was prompting these questions, it got me thinking, how about at an intersection? Because we're on a highway where traffic is moving very fast. Do we really want a sign right there where they're not paying attention to traffic coming up to a stop that might be going through, things like that? Because we have issues on Highway 1899 where those are 55, which we know people are doing 60, 65 lots of times, and they pull up to a stop, and if there's a sign there, a digital sign that takes their focus off of the defensive driving of the person going, I wonder if maybe that's something we should be looking at possibly addressing.
Chair Reed and Representative Widener, as I said earlier, the there are no additional restrictions in the bill regarding digital. So on an interstate outside of city limits or on a freeway outside of city limits, outdoor advertising signs of any kind are not allowed in an interchange or within 500 feet of the beginning or end of the interchange. Beyond that, there are no restrictions on location. The only other thing I can think of as a restriction location under the dash 8s with all of these sort of things you need to turn in, it will technically be what we call a relocation permit. Relocations are not allowed on scenic byways. So as I read the dash 8 amendment, which is different from the base bill, these things will not be allowed on scenic byways. But other than that, they can go any place else. Any other billboard could go.
So follow up, please.
So you would, even if we go back to the original bill, you would feel comfortable in the safety aspect and with not being too close to an intersection with these signs? Or maybe that's a question for Troy.
Chair Reed and Representative Widener, the department is neutral on the bill. The federal study hasn't come out. There are a couple of other studies out there.
Thank you. So, Representative Widener, do you want to go around, or do you want to introduce your amendments to the committee from where you sit?
I can go around. I have a couple people with me.
Sure.
So,
if you could stick around, how many do you want to bring up with you?
Just two.
Okay. So, maybe exactly. I think they want you this. Amy, it sounds like Representative Widener is going to bring a couple people with him, so if you might, wouldn't mind just standing by.
Minus this. I don't have them either.
Amy, it sounds like Representative Widener is going to bring two people with him, so if you wouldn't mind just standing by, that we'll have some more questions. Thanks. Go ahead, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jim Widener bringing to you now dash 10 amendments. I had dash 9s, and I think I had a dash 7 at one time, working and doing the negotiating like we all have been doing on this bill to try and get it right. I think the one thing I've hit is probably a pretty good balance with the amendments that I'm bringing forward. I have been sent out to you right now is some amendments from the garden clubs who were in favor of my dash 9s, but I'm sure they'll be in favor of my dash 10s as well. The only thing we're doing is taking out a provision that was in the 9s, which was saying you will do a two-year lease. We're leaving that open, letting the property owner and the company determine if they want to do a 10-year lease, 5-year, 1 month, however long they want to construct their lease for, they can do at that point. So, purpose behind these, this bill was one that actually came through last time in the Senate. It had passed 24 ayes, I believe, on it.
You mean a bill that is
a bill similar, that's similar to these amendments that I'm bringing forward to you this time. Yep. It's something that the property rights advocates are very strongly for, and what this amendment essentially does is just says when you have a sign location or there's a sign at your place, if the sign is taken down or the sign person who holds the sign credit goes to move the sign, the property owner can then enter an agreement with somebody else to put a sign at their location. That's the primary thrust behind this amendment. It ties in the same relating to clauses we had last time, and when we had a meeting with the sign and the sign companies the other day, in the office when we were all there, they didn't seem to have a problem with my amendment, but then I think now they do have a problem with the amendment. So, and other than that, everybody else is in favor of it. And if you want to go through it section by section, or I could have Mrs. Squires explain it to you in detail of section by section so everybody understands it thoroughly.
I think it's up to you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Reed, Beyer, and Bentz. For the record, Hasina Squires, Ms. Squires, on behalf of Icon Group. I just really quickly do want to put some things on the record since this whole digital billboard issue is separate from that digital billboard issue about the Dash 10 Amendment and what it would do. The Dash 10 Amendment would allow a landowner to rebuild a sign of the same type even though the sign was nonconforming under local code. So there are the state regulates outdoor advertising signs, and then many local jurisdictions have their own local codes that outdoor advertising signs have to comply with. Signs along state highways have to comply currently with both state and local codes. And the way that it works is the current law requires an applicant for a state sign permit to get a local jurisdiction to sign the ODOT application form that indicates, yes, this sign complies with the local code. If the local jurisdiction doesn't indicate that, then the ODOT denies the permit. This amendment would create an exception to that law, and it would prohibit a city or a county from preventing a person from replacing a sign that is in the same place, using the same materials, and has the same orientation with respect to the street. Two things that the amendment does not do: it does not create an exception for signs that are nonconforming to the state under the state law. And it does not delete the requirement that a person obtain a state permit. So it would not increase the current cap or the number of signs that are currently allowed.
Thank you. Sir?
Co-Chair Reed and members of the committee, my name is Steve Berg, and I'm here on behalf of Joe Weston and American Property Management in support of Senate Bill 639-10. Essentially, I represent a landowner in Oregon who owns several properties where outdoor advertising signs are located. We have been held hostage in the negotiation of rent by the existing sign company on more than one occasion because they own the sign structure, and if they remove it upon lease expiration, we are currently unable to obtain a permit to have it replaced. Senate Bill 639-10 would solve this issue for the landowner and allow us to offer our property to lease at market rent and to tenants with whom we choose to do business with from time to time.
Thank you very much. Questions? All in one. So Representative Lindsay, then Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Squires. The Dash 9s had, I believe, as I read it, was a limitation of 2 years on a lease. I'm glad to see a Dash 10 that eliminates that. Would you agree that a two-year limitation would be unwise?
Co-chairs Reed, Bentz, and Beyer, Representative Lindsay. Yeah, the Dash 9 amendment contained a section 8, that prevented a lease from being entered into for more than 2 years, and then also had this right of first refusal. It's a short time period. It was suggested to us, and not in an emphatic way, that it be included in the Dash 8, 9s, and several people that we've been in conversations with indicated that why would the legislature want to step in between that relationship between a landowner and a sign company.
I was one of them. Thank you. Dash 10's a lot better.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two kinds of questions. The first is I'm sort of interested in hearing about the property owner with several places where there are existing billboard structures. Are there other income-producing activities on the property or other residences? Is the property used for anything other than being the home to this billboard structure?
I believe that we have both, but oftentimes it's a commercial property where there might be an office building or a retail center. Yes.
Follow.
I'd like to ask about the other thing, which is actually a much larger issue. Realizing now that the language is a new preemption on local authority, so I know that sometimes the state does say, we know best and we're not going to let local government make decisions about this, that, or the other thing. But this would be a new kind of preemption. We've just heard in previous testimony that we intentionally allow local jurisdictions to adopt sign codes that may be more restrictive in spacing or placement or some other kinds of requirements. So this would be not only an exception, this would mark a departure in that. We'd be saying, well, we believe in local authority for managing the public interest or public safety in all those other kinds of signs, but not this one kind of sign. And I don't understand the distinction. Does that mean that there's going to be a suggestion then that we preempt local authority for all the other signs that they're writing rules about? I'm very concerned about that, because sometimes trying to manage an urban area is different than trying to manage a highway. There's a lot going on, and there's public interest at stake, whether it's urban design and aesthetic issues or literally public safety issues. I just find it kind of odd. You know, we allow... for example, local governments sometimes need to ensure that over time, non-conforming uses, which might be a very unsafe building or one without access for disabled or other sorts of concerns, that over time that That has to go away. They're kind of like grandfathered in until you want to change the use or make some real big change, and then, hey, it's time to fix up this thing that's no longer conforming. But what
Mr.
I hear
Chair.
Here is that if it's non-conforming, they still are allowed to keep it.
So, Representative Nathan,
so is there anything I misunderstand about we're starting to do a preemption now that we haven't done before?
Joe Winder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nathanson, what we're trying to get at is that you have conforming and non-conforming signs on state highways. The non-conforming signs are allowed by state. Is what happens is somebody comes in, has a contract with a property owner, and says, well, we're going to pay you $200 a month. And it might be they don't keep things up. They may be very, very bad tenants, and you're the property owner. Well, the only option you have right now is cancel your agreement and lose the rent for the sign completely. This would allow you, they could take their sign credit, go someplace else and put it up, but it would allow the property owner to then enter an agreement with another sign owner or somebody who has a credit. There's only a few companies in the states that have these credits, but now they can come and erect the exact same sign and probably do a much better job of keeping it up to date, maintaining. They may pay you more rent, things like that. That's all this amendment really is doing. So it's allowing you to enter an agreement.
Maybe I can clarify something then, too, that I think I go in circles in my own mind. For a while, I think I understand it, and then I get confused again. Tell me about the connection between the I think I understand the concern about a particular landowner being unable to find an alternative if they can't come to agreement with the sign company. How does that relate to the non-conforming piece? In other words, is it possible to solve the first problem about not having the landowner not having an alternative mm-hmm. if they can't come to agreement with the original sign company without getting into the concern that Representative Nathanson expresses around the conformity question?
Co-chairs Reed, Byer, and Bench, my answer to that would be that's the whole enchilada that you asked us not to talk about, which is the entire issue of the monopolistic nature that the state has created by the credit system and the bank system and how things currently work today.
But is it possible to deal with without getting into the non-conformance question? I mean, I think I get the other question, but tell me about the conformance. I'm not even sure if I'm using the right form of the word, conformity, conformance.
Co-Chair Reed, I think Representative Nathanson is right on when she says this is a preemption on local government. We are talking about non-conforming signs that at one point were in compliance. Then local code came in. They adopted a local code, grandfathered some certain signs in, and then they are now not compliant, but they're still up. This is not about really necessarily this, from Representative Widener's perspective, not necessarily about the non-conformance issue. Representative Nathanson's issue is about the non-conformance issue and the preemption on local government. For Representative Widener's perspective, it's about the landowner having options with a currently non-conforming sign. What is it that they can do with a non-conforming sign versus nothing or nothing and continue on with the current tenant that they have on their property or have a different alternative, and that's what this amendment's about.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Smith?
I have the same question, and I am in favor of the objective of seeing if we can free things up a little bit for some of the for some of the additional players. I am wondering if there's any way to serve that objective in the Dash 10s that is something different than or short of preempting local governments. Maybe the whole point is we've got the only way to help is to, in this way, is to preempt local governments. Is there a way to move towards the objectives of Dash 10s, setting aside, taking out entirely the system of credits or whatever? Is there a way to do that, or I'm trying to understand, or is that so close to the essence of what it is that that's kind of the essence of what it is?
Co-chairs Reed, Byer, and Bence, Representative Smith. I think it is. This amendment is what it is.
Okay.
I think there are other things that could be explored, but they would venture into a very bigger, more complicated issue that many of us have sat in the room and studied for months and months and months.
Thanks. Other questions? Representative Anderson.
It's not a question, but this is for the witnesses, but maybe for my colleagues. It seems like we're going to have some policy trade-offs here between encouraging or supporting competition in outdoor advertising, looking after or protecting property owner interests, but that's really a contract issue. Property owners for income-earning purposes have entered into contracts with advertising interests. So are we trying to protect that contract interest, or not a contract interest, protect that income-earning ability? What are we trying to do with regard to encouraging competition in outdoor advertising? And then another policy question about preemption versus local control. And those are all in conflict right now, I think. And from what I'm hearing at the table, at least some of us are interested in supporting one or two of those objectives, but maybe less interested in another. I don't think this particular amendment gets at everything I'd be interested in. I'm interested in some of that, but not in usurping local control outright on this kind of sign, but none of the other kind of signs or other nonconforming uses that may be hazardous. There's other reasons why we allow local control.
Representative Lindsay.
I'll take a stab at this, answering your question. So I was involved in a land use issue, still am actually, as an attorney out at the coast, and a homeowner has a nonconforming use permit to build their house in certain ways that would not be in conformance nowadays. They're grandfathered in, and they can continue to build that house in that certain way because they were promised that from the city years and years ago. Now, they could even tear down their house and rebuild it in the nonconforming way again. Now, I don't think that is necessarily usurping local control. It's just giving the landowner what they were given originally and not usurping the landowner. So in my mind, I don't see that there's too much conflict here. You have a landowner that entered into an agreement with a sign owner and got the permission of the city to do that. The city changed its mind years later. That sign is now non-conforming use. And should that homeowner ever want to change contractors, they should be allowed to do so based on what was promised by the city years and years ago. So you keep that grandfather clause in there. And it permits the landowner to have more decision-making authority for their land. And I don't see it usurping the city's local control. It's protecting the individual homeowners that has made decision on promises made by the city previously. And then as far as the environmental portion of it, I see digital billboards as a huge leap in favor of environmentalism. That's why I support it. I think it's a great option there. I think by exchanging a digital billboard for taking some down will disincentivize people from making that decision to go toward that more environmentally friendly option. And that's why I think 10 sound logical to me.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please.
I think in simple terms, the way to put it is, as a landlord, you have some renters in your apartment. Your property taxes, expenses, and everything go up all the time. And you have a renter who says, I'm only going to pay $200 a month. And if you throw them out, you get no renter. So you can't, and that's the way it is for the sign guys right now. They have a tenant there that says, we're only going to pay you $200 a month or $2,000, whatever the number is. And yet your expenses are going up. You can't raise the rent or the lease on them because they'll just leave, and at that point your apartment's empty. And you still have to pay the taxes and everything else on it. So it's kind of a simple way of putting it, but I think that's something that they face, and we have a property owner over here who might be able to describe it or tell me if I'm right or wrong on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Chair and the committee, You know, thinking about this aspect of control, it's like currently we have one player that's dictating what we can do with our land. And if we don't agree with what they're saying, they're going to take their ball and they're going to go home. And so from that standpoint, it's either play with them or play with no one. And, you know, so we do see this. It's not just the owners getting sucked in by the sign companies to come up with this. We really feel like it really is a land control issue that we should have the right to negotiate with whoever a potential tenant might be and retain that.
So I'm getting the cue that our time is drawing to a close as people are starting to come forward. Representative Byer.
Thank you. I'll be real quick, and you can maybe even offer me the information offline. I do also have the concern. I've had it in the past about a local preemption, which this is. And while maybe there is some concern about the individuals who own these signs, if someone could maybe, as you talk about, as their expenses go up, if someone could get me information about what those expenses might be to actually having a sign on your property, that would be going up. Me, I'm not sure I understand what they would be. The talk about property taxes, you know, maybe, but whatever else, it would be helpful for me to know what those expenses might be.
Very quickly, please.
Sure. Coaches Reed, Byer, and Bentz, just one quick thing that is not on the dash 10, so I just wanted to point out in the dash 8 that I just had a question on.
Sure.
In the dash 8 on page 2, lines 18 through 20, when we're talking about the little guys, we're talking about a digital sign, an applicant for, with 10% or less. Lines 18 through 20 contain a requirement that the permit or relocation credit turned in must be for signs with a display surface of at least 250 square feet. That same requirement doesn't exist for the big guys, if you want to term it, them that way. The bulletin size is 672, poster size is 300. I just want to point out to the committee that most of the little guys, their signs aren't 250 square feet, they're 200 square feet or less, so I'm not sure, I wasn't sure if that was an error or if it was intentional.
Okay.
Take a look. A quick question, which you might be able to answer. Do the dash 10s, are they contemplated to be able to live alongside the dash 8s, or are they mutually exclusive?
Co-chairs Reed, Byer, Bentz, they were crafted as they could be a standalone amendment,
they could be adopted
in conjunction with the 8s.
Thanks. And I would also like to talk offline on, and I'm feeling confused in ways I wish I weren't, but I don't want to burden everybody else with that.
Thank you. I think that's probably true for all of us in different ways.
Right.
Craig Honeyman did express an interest in weighing in on the dash 10, 9s, now 10s, I think, quickly, so we could probably have about 60 seconds for you if you still want to do that. I'm sorry for the late hour.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was hoping to be able to include Brenda Wilson and Eugene in this commentary, too.
Very quickly, and here comes the City of Portland, too.
Oh, okay. Craig Honeyman, League of Oregon Cities, thank you for the opportunity to testify during this work session. Actually, I have a statement that I'd like to pass out, and it was drafted relative to the Dash 7 amendments, which I got yesterday. There's since been Dash 9s. Which I got this morning, and dash 10s a few minutes ago. So please substitute dash 10s in this statement and section 6, where I refer to section 8. The League of Oregon Cities opposes the amendments, the dash 10 amendments to 639, as they effectively remove local control over sign ordinances and restrictions. In the instance of an existing sign being replaced under the conditions provided in Section 6, the legislation requires cities to continue to submit affidavits to applicants, even though the new replacement sign may not comply with their local ordinance. Worthy of note, the Dash 10 amendments are virtually identical to the Dash 2 amendments offered to Senate Bill 607 in the 2009 session. The Dash 2 amendments did not pass then, and the Dash 10 amendments should not pass now. They are quite simply, as we've already noted, a preemption of local sign ordinances at a time when several cities are seeking to, over time, phase out non-conforming advertising signs. So Section 6 of the Dash 10s basically permanently would permit such signage. We did not oppose Senate Bill 639 when it first came to you as it related to digital signs. The Dash 10s relate to all signs. And so if they are contained in the bill, the League of Oregon Cities will have to oppose the legislation. Thank you for your
attention. Thank you, Ms. Wilson.
Thank you. Chair Reed, Chair Benz, Brenda Wilson with the City of Eugene. We would agree with the League of Oregon Cities that the City of Eugene was neutral on Senate Bill 639, but we would oppose Senate Bill 639 if the Dash 7s, the Dash 9s, or the Dash 10s were introduced. We agree with Representative Nathanson that while the proponents of the amendments have raised an issue, it sounds like they have a contract issue in a business agreement that cannot work out. We believe that the goals of land use are to address important public purposes such as maintaining neighborhood character, protecting public safety, and as Representative Weidner pointed out, to remove unnecessary distractions from motorists on the roadway. What we're talking about are non-conforming signs that we believe that once they outlive their life would be taken down and be replaced or not replaced so that they were conforming with local ordinances. This is an exception to that, and we really appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Mr. Berenberg, if there's anything new to add, don't feel compelled to repeat what has been said, please.
Mr. Chair, one new thing to add, which is that there was a unanimous three-judge panel ruling of the Oregon Court of Appeals that affirmed Portland's current sign code today. A 25-page ruling. Our attorneys are just reading that, and that's something that is hot off the presses, and I'll stop talking, but tell you about it later. Thank you.
Certainly counts as new if it's done today. Thank you very much. Thank you. Committee, good discussion here. Appreciate the contributions, and we do have two meetings left in which to consider what we might do with these amendments in this bill. Look forward to your continued discussion, and see you Friday if there's nothing else to come before the meeting today. Representative Smith, anything to add? I'm gonna drop the gavel.
I have to go ahead and gavel.
Okay, here we go. We're adjourned.
Not on the record.